my trip to the chair, Willie Francis, they tell me that this is the first time anyone ever had a chance to tell the story of how it feels to go to the electric chair and know that you might not have to go back, admit you might have to go back there. This is the first time I ever told the whole story, and I hope that by at last telling it, people will understand what it means to go through what I went through. I hope it will help people to do the right thing and live right. I know how it felt to have them read a death warrant to me. I know how it feels to sit in a cell waiting for the day they will lead me to the chair again. I sure know how it feels to sit in the chair and have them strap me in and put a mask on my eyes. I know how it feels to have the shock go through me and think I am dead but find out I am not. I don't like to talk about it at all, but if it will help other people understand each other, I want to tell everything. A lot of people write to me and ask me to tell them something about what I did when I was young. I'm only 18 now, so I guess they mean when I was very young. I don't want to talk about the killing of Mr. Thomas. When they asked me to write this story, I said I would only if I didn't have to say anything about that part. I was tried and convicted of the killing, and as far as I think, that's all over. But I will tell you about the electrocution. At the beginning of April, the sheriff came to tell me that I had to go to the electric chair on the 3rd of May. He said the governor had written my death warrant. It was funny, the way it was written. Read real careful, like they thought I might say, you can't kill me because you have a word wrong on the paper. Boy, you sure feel funny when you know you're going to almost die. Almost like you know something only God should know. The day before I was in the electric chair, I was plenty scared. Father Hannigan came to see me. He knew I was scared. He told me something funny. He said I was lucky because I knew when I was going to die, and so I could prepare myself in time. I had never thought about dying that way before. All I could see was that I wouldn't be alive anymore. What he said made me feel a little better. He said he might fall down the jailhouse steps and break his neck, or maybe he would die between clean sheets in his rectory that night. Anyway, he would never know, and I would. He said I had a new life to start when I got up from that chair the next day, and I shouldn't start like a little crybaby. Even though I was only 16, he said, I had this one big chance to prove I was able to die like a man. It is one of the hardest things to make yourself learn how to die right. I kept thinking that tomorrow I'll be dead, and they will bury me in a cold, cold grave. I wondered what it would look like, and I tried to see myself, in my mind, looking at my own grave marker. Later on, I got on my knees and said my prayers for what I thought would be the last time. I said, God, tonight is the last time I will sleep in a bed, because tomorrow I will have to sit down on that chair and die. Please help me die. It's a hard thing to get into your head. It seemed so unreal. At this point, they put him in the death chamber, in the chair, and they put a hood on him. Everything seemed to be finished because everyone looked stranger than before. The sheriff was looking back at me, and when someone said, all right, he stepped next to me and asked me if there was something I would like to say before they pulled the switch on me. I was thinking about saying I didn't blame anyone for what they were doing to me, but I couldn't talk. I didn't see my whole life in front of my eye like they say you're supposed to. Not being able to see made me even more scared. I heard moving around and mumbling all around on all sides of me. Then, off to the left side, I heard a voice I hadn't heard until then say to me, goodbye, Willie. It was funny the way he said it, like he was telling me goodbye and I was going off on a trip. I wanted to say goodbye too, but I was so scared I couldn't talk. My hands were closed tightly. Then I could almost hear it coming. The best way I can describe it is wham.
We'll be reading sonnets from Jill McDonough's Habeas Corpus. May 3rd, 1946, Willie Francis, St. Martinsville, Louisiana. They brought Louisiana's only chair and a pickup from Angola into St. Martinsville Parish, to the courthouse, where a 15-year-old colored boy had lain on straw for months. Jailhouse on the second floor, death kindly took the elevator. Wires were tossed from a dynamo to window. Four men setting up the chair passed flasks, dead tired and innocent of amps. They called the priest and pulled the switch and thought he'd die. He shook and lurched and gasped. You're not supposed to breathe. They shut it down, freed him from the straps and hood. Then Willie Francis stood up and without help and, miracle, miracle, walked back to his cell.
December 26, 1862, Mankato, Minnesota, Chaska. After the massacre, 300 Sioux were tried and condemned, but Lincoln made that 38. They'd raped or murdered. One Chaskadon knifed a pregnant woman, carved the baby out. But Chaska got jail time. A woman testified he'd saved her life. The gallows was a crowded square built to hang, at once, 10 men each side. Singing in a doleful harmony, hooded, bound, they tried to take one another by the hand. Sarah Wakefield, the woman Chaska saved, read this in the papers and saw that he'd been hanged. Officials apologized for their mistake. Chaskadon, not Chaska, was to have died. I'm not ashamed to acknowledge that I cried.
August 23rd, 1927, Nicolas Sacco, Charlestown, Massachusetts. Vanzetti said to quit the hunger strike, but Sacco stalled. Why fatten up before you're killed? When he ate for strength to write. Be strong, dear Dante, comfort your mother. Or, Ines, in every angle, this sad walled cell, and everywhere my gaze rests, I love you much, then so much. On the 23rd, the tall doors of the Athenaeum's reading room saw someone slip small flyers into all the magazines. Their voices are gone, but will be remembered in gratitude and tears. Exalted shall be these working men and dreamers, killed by judges, scholars, governors, whose names have gone down into everlasting shame.
October 9th, 2002, Eileen Wuornos, Stark, Florida. That makeup on Charlize Theron and how the murders piled up, the first in self-defense, then all the rest. In theaters, crowds of people streamed out, silent, shocked. Her death warrants online, Adobe Acrobat. And Netflix has two documentaries with interviews and trials, old photographs. She says she's getting all the tears out of me and stuff so I won't cry in jazz, to tough it out as tough as I can. This used to be called Dying Game. In the end, that wasn't enough. You sabotaged my ass, society! Inhumane fucking living bastards and bitches who used me for money, for books and movies and shit.
I'm reading Capital Punishment by Sherman Alexie. I prepare the last meal for the Indian man to be executed, but the killer doesn't want much. Baked potatoes, salad, glass of cold water. I'm not a witness. It's mostly the dark ones who are forced to sit in the chair, especially when white people die. It's true, you can look it up, and this Indian killer pushed his fist all the way down a white man's throat just to win a bet about the size of his heart. Those Indians are always gambling. Still, I season this last meal with all I have. I don't have much, but I send it down the line with the handsome guard who has fallen in love with the Indian killer. I don't care who loves whom. I'm not a witness. When it's the warden's stew, I don't care if I add too much salt or pepper. For the boss, I just cook. He can eat what I put in front of him. But for the Indian man to be executed, I cook it just right. The temperature's the thing. I once heard a story about a black man who was electrocuted in that chair and lived to tell about it before the court decided to sit him back down an hour later and kill him all over again. I have an extra sandwich hidden away in the back of the refrigerator in case this Indian killer survives that first slow flip of the switch and gets hungry while he waits for the engineers to debate the flaws. I'm not a witness. I prepare the last meal for free, just like I signed up for the last war. I learned how to cook by lasting longer than any of the others. Tonight, I'm just the last one left after the handsome guard takes the meal away. I turn off the kitchen lights and sit alone in the dark because the whole damn prison dims when the chair is switched on. You can watch a light bulb flicker on a night like this and remember it too clearly, like it was your first kiss or the first hard kick to your groin. It's all the same when I'm huddled down here trying not to look at the clock. Don't look at the clock. Look at the clock. No, don't look at the clock. When all of it stops making sense, a salad, a potato, a drink of water all taste like heat. I'm not a witness. I want you to know I tasted a little of that last meal before I sent it away. It's the cook's job to make sure, and I was sure I ate from the same plate and ate with the same fork and spoon that the Indian killer used later in his cell. Maybe a little piece of me lodged in his mouth, wedged between his front teeth, his incisors, his molars, when he chewed down on the bit, and his body arced like modern art, curving organically, smoke rising from his joints, wispy flames decorating the crown of his head, the balls of his feet. I'm not a witness. I sit here in the dark kitchen when they do it, meaning when they kill him, kill and add another definition of the word to the dictionary. America fills its dictionary. We write down kill, and everybody in the audience shouts out exactly how they spell it, what it means to them, and all of the answers are taken down by pollsters and secretaries who keep track of the small details, time of death, pulse rate, press release. I heard a story once about some reporters at a hanging who wanted the hood removed from the condemned's head so they could look into his eyes and tell their readers what they saw there. What did they expect? All of the stories should be simple. One death plus one death equals two deaths. But we throw the killers in one grave and the victims in another. We form sides and have two separate feasts. I'm not a witness. I prepared the last meal for the Indian man who was executed and have learned this. If any of us stood for days on top of a barren hill during an electrical storm, then lightning would eventually strike us, and we'd have no idea for which of our sins we were reduced to headlines and ash.
Azeem Khamisa, whose 20-year-old son Tariq was shot and killed by Tony Hicks. At age 14, Hicks was tried as an adult. He pled guilty and received 25 years to life. I decided to become the enemy not of my son's killer, but of the forces that put a young boy on a dark street holding a handgun. Tony Hicks now writes letters from prison that we use in our programs and that we see having a positive effect on the other kids. Think of how many kids he may save. That's going to bring me a lot more healing than if he had gotten the death penalty.
From Loretta Filipov, whose husband, Alexander Filipov, was killed on September 11, 2001. We can see from the present course we are following that violence only begets more violence, and killing only leads to more killing. It is possible to have justice without revenge and hate. The death penalty is not the answer.
I had only anger toward the man who murdered my mother and thought about what his punishment should be if he were ever caught. It seemed to me that he should suffer and die in the same horrible way he forced my mother to. I had to rethink the death penalty when I became a mother myself. I realized that if I had a child who grew up to be a murderer, I would never stop loving him. The degree of love I felt would be the same as the first day I held him. With this realization, I found complete forgiveness. I also knew my mother would never want someone killed in her name, as I don't want anyone murdered in mine. The insanity of the death penalty has to end, and I oppose it under any circumstance. This is from Susie Klassen, whose mother, Helen Bowen Klassen, was murdered when Susie was 11 years old.
I was surprised to receive the last book you sent me, the Norton Anthology of American Literature, Volume 2. That book is the best book that I've received in all 5 years of my time here at Huntonville. I'll treasure it for many years to come. It turns out that the story I informed you of that I wrote was selected for publication and has become the winner. I've enclosed a copy of the press review. I owe it all to APBP for sending me a book called The Toughest Indian in the World. The next four speakers will be reading letters.
Will you please send me a dictionary with a zillion words in it? I am 60 years old and have been in prison 23 years, with life to go. But I can read even the smallest of print. I want to thank you for the last book that you sent me, John Milton's Paradise Lost. I have tried for over 3 years to obtain a copy and had almost given up on being able to find one.
Thank you for existing. I'm so glad there are people that care about those that society wants to push out of sight. I'm hoping you can send some reading material to my son. He likes Stephen King. Under the Dome would be awesome. He also likes Dean Koontz and J.R.R. Tolkien. Also, if you have any self-help books about acknowledging your shortcomings, making self-improvement, and getting on with your life, that would be great. I'm writing for a gentleman who is illiterate. He is wanting to know if you could send him a dictionary and also a book or two that could help him to read and write better, somewhere around the fifth grade level.
You sent me a medication guide and a Rand McNally World Atlas. When I got them, I was excited as a six-year-old kid on Christmas morning. Thank you so much for taking the time to find the books and for sending them to me. As far as I'm concerned, you and everybody at APPP are the bomb. It's hard to believe that there's actually a group like yours providing books to inmates, especially trying to match the inmates' interest with the book you send them. Bless you. I just finished reading the Harry Potter series back to back, twice, and now I'm suffering from post-Potter depression because I wish the series would just go on and on. So I borrowed book number one from a fellow criminal, and I'm going to start reading all over again.
These next two poems are by Delbert Tibbs. A poem for no reason. These songs are usually born for some reason. A thought that one thinks immortal or ought to be. Or to help brothers and sisters see something curious or something seldom seen. The intense green of the earth. The awe and wonder at the birth of a child and death. Things we want to share with our kindred. But a poem for no reason? I did meet a sweet little woman named Season, but she is not the reason for this song. Once, long, long ago, I heard some sounds and some silences that sparked a fire in me and no form that I know could contain. It and even Leonardo or Donnie Ray Carter could never frame it. So terrible it was. Reason alone could never explain it. And I have been on it ever, since always.
It's hard to be a poet. This is not the place for thought that does not end in concreteness. It is not easy to be open or too curious. It is dangerous to dwell too much on things. To wonder who or why or when, to wonder how, is dangerous. How do we, the people, get out of this hole? What's the way to fight? Might I do what Richard and Ralph and Langston and them did? It is not easy to be a poet here, yet I sing. I sing. This is the place for thoughts that do not end in concreteness. It is necessary to be curious and dangerous to dwell here. To wonder why and how and when is dangerous. But that's how we get out of this hole. It is not easy to be a poet here, yet I sing. We sing.